We are in Perek Lamed. And we actually started this Perek. It'll probably take us 2 weeks to learn through the different material here, so let's assume 2 weeks for Perek Lamed. Perek Lamed Aleph, most of it we've read, we're just going to do a couple of pieces on it. So, and that's it. That's the end of Shmuel Aleph. So my plan is to continue for as long as it takes to finish Shmuel Aleph, then give you all a break, give me a break, and then and then Sat Hashem after the Chagim we'll start Shmuel Bet.
Wow, that's going to be a long time. We can't meet a few weeks before the Chagim?
Nah,
August.
Chagim are always late in August. Late. We're going later than we have ever gone before, so
true.
I'm kind of making up for it now
okay. At
this end, because typically I'm not here in June,
Rabbi, you
July.
Should be happy that we won it.
I am very happy, but I know my schedule pre-Yontif, and it's going to be even worse this year.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's... I would be fooling you if I said to you that I thought it was doable before Yontif. So I'll make up for it by taking us a few extra weeks now.
Well, did I tell you that I did actually hear Rav Maidan speak this year?
And
it was, he spoke Erev Yom HaTzma'ut.
Yeah, what did he speak about?
I thought he was going to give a Dvar Torah. Sorry, I just want to tell
you. No, that's okay. I appreciate that. All right. We are in Perek Lamed. The first part of this Perek we read and included in our study of Perek Chavtet. So I am going to just reread it for the sake of the complete picture of the Perek. But we've already looked at it. Vahi bevod David va'anashav tziklag bayom hashlishi, on the third day from what?
When he was turned away from the...
Correct. Third day after having been released from...
I don't know how far he got.
So actually, you know, that's what this map is. And I thought I'd given you this map, but I'll share it with you again. This is the map from Perek Chavtet.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning this is the map
of
the previous piece, or Perek Lamed Aleph. Yeah, well, it's really Chavtet. Okay, so if you look at the southern part of this map, there are two lines. The solid line represents the army of Shaul, and the broken line represents the army of the Plishtim. And if you look where this map starts, the Plishtim start from?
Afek.
So, you sort of have to, you know what? You kind of have to use both these maps together. Here's another one. Afek is just north of the Nachal that runs north of Yafo. You see that?
So it's right near Yafo.
Yeah, it's north of Yafo.
East of Yafo, I guess.
Yeah, northeast of Yafo. And the Plishtim, actually, if you look at the larger map, the blown out map,
this one.
So the map that has the whole country on it, you sort of get a sense of where things are. Eretz Plishtim in the south along the coast, and the cities of Eretz Plishtim, Grar, Aza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gat. Those are your five primary cities of. Six primary cities of the Plishtim. You can see where Tziklag is.
Yes.
Okay, Tziklag is the city on the border with Israel that Gat, that Achish had given to David. If you follow along the coast from Ashdod north, you'll get to the city of Yafo. And just north of Yafo, there's a little river. I think that's the Arkon, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And just north of it is where it says the Mem of Ephraim. You see the Mem of the word Ephraim?
Yeah.
That's where Afek is. If you look on the other map, you'll see Afek. So you kind of get the sense that the army of the Plishtim are gathering in Afek. That's what happened in the end in Perek Chavtet.
So that's part of Tel Aviv today.
Part of the Gush Dan area. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's still Tel Aviv.
Correct. So that's where they're gathering their forces. And that's where they have this whole conversation with David back in Perek Chavtet. They free David from his obligation. David comes back 3 days later to Tziklag, and you can sort of measure from the Mem of Ephraim to Tziklag, it takes him 3 days to travel that distance. So, more or less, it's a little bit less than equidistant to the area of Emek Yisrael, where the Plishtim then moved their forces. Mm. From as David heads south, Achish marches north to Emek Yisrael. Do you see where it says, best way to do this is, well, you can see the word Yisrael.
Yeah,
you see the word Yisrael?
Yeah.
So, more or less, that's where the battle takes place. So, literally, Afek is, I would say, by distance from Tziklag is literally midway. Mm-hmm. Now, it takes a little bit longer for an army to get to move than it does for David and his 600 men. So, maybe David gets to Tziklag before before Achish gets to Emek Yisrael. Unclear, but I would argue, because of the way the story is presented, that it's happening on the same day. So they're literally equidistant. David is heading south down to Tziklag, and Achish is heading north into Emek Yisrael. That's this other map. You kind of get a sense of where the battle is taking place. Shaul is moving from Achish is moving from Afek to the area of Shunem, right? And Shaul is moving from Givat Shaul up to Har Gilboa. So Har Gilboa is on neither of these maps, but you kind of sense...
But it's near Beit Shan.
It's near Beit Shan, right?
But where's Shunem? I don't see that.
It's not on the map. Well, it's on the other map.
Ah.
It's on the other map.
Oh, yeah.
So these two maps together kind of give you a sense of
so
the trajectory of what's
is
going
where
on.
The battle is.
Okay. Yeah, well, the Plishtim come from the coast, so they end up on the northern ridge,
yeah.
And Shaul is coming through the mountain, so he ends up on the southern side of the valley.
Yeah.
And the valley between Har Gilboa on one side and Shunem on the other. Okay. And actually, according to this map, Ein Dor is not on the coast. But Endor is right near,
it's above
Shunem. So I'm not quite sure how he gets to Endor, if the Plishtim are north of him, but that's not my headache. That's Shaul's headache.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so back to Perek Lamed. We are going to focus on David in Tziklag. And Tziklag is south, back in his hometown. And so we're going to work off this map for today. That's our primary discussion. Vayi bevod David v'anashav Tziklag v'yom ha-shlishi v'amaleki pashtu el negev v'el Tziklag v'yaku et Tziklag v'yisrifu ota be'esh. This we studied last week, that Amalek had attacked in the interim while the army of the Plishtim had gone north, and they attacked the whole southern region, the Negev, Tziklag included, and burnt it to the ground. Vayishbu et hanashim asheba mikaton v'ad gadol lo emitu ish v'yinagu v'yelchu ledarkam. Captured all the women and children, took them into captivity, didn't kill anybody. That's both a good thing, because David will eventually catch up to them, but it's also a reflection of the purpose of Amalek's raid, which is to capture slaves and to sell them as slaves. And they were slave traders, marauders, nomads, and slave traders. Part of the moral issue that the Torah has with Amalek is not just that they attack, but that they are, but the moral code by which they live was abhorrent and was something that needed to be dealt with. They were essentially nomadic slave traders, what in today's world we would say are terrorists. Right, they'll kidnap, they'll attack the weak and the stragglers, they'll attack the defenseless, capture them as slaves, sell them as slaves. Ve'yinagu ve'yilchu ledarka. Ve'yavod David v'anashav el ha'ir v'inei surfa ba'esh u'nishahem u'vnehem u'vnotahem ishbu. David comes back to the city, and everybody in the city is taken captive. Just going to turn... turn my phone off from buzzing me. Vayavod David v'neshev al even is pasuk dalet. Vayisad David v'ama shirito et kolam v'yivku ad asher en behem koach livkot. They sat, they cried, till they had no strength left to even cry, to mourn the loss of every civilian in the city of Tziklag. Remember, they don't know that they were attacked by Amalek, and they don't know that they were taken into captivity. They simply don't know the fate of everybody who was left behind. They came back to the city was razed to the ground, and everybody was gone. Including David's own two wives. David was greatly distressed, not only because of his own loss, but because the people blamed him for their loss. They were ready to stone him, embittered because of the loss of their sons and daughters. They blame David. Why do they blame David?
Because he left the city unprotected.
Because he had left the city unprotected. B, the reason he left the city unprotected was to go fight Achish's war against Shaul, which has a certain... When we talked about the controversy around that decision, which may have been a subject of great discussion, and not everybody would have agreed with David's decision. And so it's not hard to blame David for that moment. But on the other hand, David didn't let it destroy him. David took strength in his faith in God. David calls over Evyatar HaKohen, the Kohen Gadol, son of Achimelech, Kohen Gadol from the city of Nov. He's been with him since the fall of Nov. Bring me the Ephod or the Urim V'Tumim. Brings it to David. Ve'ishal David b'Hashem lemor, erdof acharei hagdud hazeh, ha'asigenu. Should I follow against this band, this group? These attackers. He doesn't name them by name because
he doesn't know
who it was. Right? He will eventually find out, but he doesn't yet know. We know more information than he does, obviously, because text has told us. Should I go? Will I be successful? Go, you will be successful, you will catch up to them, and you will save the people. And that's where we left off last week, where we looked at the context of this introduction in light of Perek Chavtet, particularly the fact that David's moral dilemma in Perek Chavtet demonstrated a weakness or a deficiency in David's case because he didn't seek counsel from the Urim V'Tumim, whereas here he realized his mistake and at that moment seeks counsel of the Urim V'Tumim, which is a trademark of David HaMelech. So for now I want to read through the rest of the story. Ve'elech David hu v'shesh milot ish asher ito. ויבוא עד נחל הבשור. והנותרים עמדו. David and his 600 men went south. I'm not sure if they know where they're going, but they're heading south. Follow the trail. And they reached Nachal Besor. Now Nachal Besor, I'm not 100% sure where on the map it is, but Nachal Besor exists today. You can go. It's one of the famous hikes that they take people through. It's a dry wadi.
Sounds pretty dramatic. If 200 people said they can't make it.
Because you know what happens to dry wadis?
They can fill
pretty quickly with water, right?
Okay,
that's
exactly
right. Vanotarim amadu. So they get 600 men get to the Nachal. 400 succeed in getting through, but the other 200 they simply can't get through. Amadu, and they are stuck. Vayardof David hu v'arbamiot ish. So David and the 400 that managed to cross, they will continue the chase. Vayamdu matayim ish asher pigru me'avor et nachal abesor. And the remaining 200 who tarried and weren't able to cross over Nachal Besor, they remained behind. Now, those two psukim seem to be somewhat, I don't know, how would you describe them?
Strange. Why would you leave 200 people behind?
Well, you leave 200 people behind because you're heading south. The army is, it's a matter of, the timing is critical in this campaign, and they got stuck because, I'm assuming they got stuck because the Nachal became too heavy to cross over. So they'll stay behind. They'll watch over the camp. David will later will call them Elu Ayoshvim al Akilim. They'll watch the equipment.
Oh.
Right.
Okay.
They are
physically not able to.
Well, so this is a whole discussion, and I'm going to not get into the details of it too much, but it's a whole discussion as to why they didn't cross, what happened to those 200. Most of the Mefarshim, I would say, probably sort of the classic or traditional, is that they pigru, meaning they tarried and they just got too lazy. They didn't want to make the effort. And you'll see later on the 400 who do, they resent terribly the 200 who didn't make it across. More likely scenario is that, you know, these nachals are not easy to cross at the best of times. They're not necessarily dry nachals. They could be rivers. They're not necessarily the easiest to cross. And it's a matter of timing. Because all you need is a flash flood. All you need is a little bit of rain. And they become impassable. And so we don't necessarily know what time of year it is. But it's possible that we're dealing with a seasonal winter type of moment in Israel, where there's water in the Nachal, and they can fill up very quickly, very suddenly. We had a similar scenario back in Sefer Shoftim with the Battle of Sisra and the armies and Barak, also in Emek Israel. If you remember in the Nachal Kishon, in Shirat Devorah, she talks about Nachal Kishon, the rains came, and Nachal Kishon Grafam, and Nachal Kishon literally swallowed up the chariots of the enemy. Because all you need is one good sudden downpouring or cloudburst to turn a dry Nachal into a mud bog, or worse, a flash flood. And so Metana is this theory that actually that's what happened here, and that's what David was hoping was going to happen to Shaul in Har Gilboa. If it's already raining, they'll let it rain up there and wipe out the forces of Plishtim, and Shaul will be victorious. It obviously didn't happen that way, because the destiny of that battle was supposed to go in a different direction. Be that as it may, these two. So the Mefarshim suggests that there was some antagonism here, that these two got lazy. These 200 got lazy. I'm not 100% sure that they got lazy as much as they got stopped. But in all cases, 400 continue, 200 remain behind. That piece of the story will come back to us at the end. After the battle is over, we're going to come back to the story of these 200. It's almost like a framework of the story is a story within a story. There's the story of David and his 600 men and the internal struggle they have between the 200 and the 400, beginning and end. And in the middle is the story of Amalek. And I'll show you that in a moment. Vayimtzu'u ish mitzri basadeh. They're traveling through, and they come across an ish mitzri. Vayikhu oto al David. And they brought him to David. Who brought him to David? Men from his gedut, from his 400 men. Vayitnu lechem vayochal vayashkuhu mayim. They gave him bread, they gave him water. Right? They found a guy off the side of the street, a mitzri, literally on the edge of, on the verge of death, hungry, hadn't eaten in days, he was sick, hadn't drunk anything. He was literally about to... So they stopped, and they gave him some bread, and they gave him some food, and they gave him some water, and they revived him a little bit. The poor guy, he was sitting on the side of the road. What are you going to do? You can't just leave him there. Right. They gave him some figs, they gave him some raisins. Right, you can't give him too much, because he hadn't eaten for so long. If you give him too much,
get sick.
Right, he'll get sick. Vayochal Vatashav Rucho Alav. And by eating, he was able to revive himself, revive his spirit, to be able to gain some strength. This is a recurring theme in these three chapters. If you don't eat, you don't have strength. Who else did not eat and did not have strength?
Shaul.
Shaul, back in chapter 28. And why did he need his spirit revived? Ki lo achalechem lo shetamayim shloshei amim shloshei lelot. He had not eaten or drunk anything for 3 days. If you don't drink water for 3 days, you're going to be pretty sick. So there's 3 psukim devoted here to the fact that David and his men fed this guy. Think about it, they're running on a chase to this gedud to catch them before they escape with all of the women and children. And they find an abandoned man dying of hunger and thirst on the side of the road. They stop the entire pursuit. They hold. They take this guy. They give him some food, give him some water. They can't leave a guy abandoned like that on the side of the street. You just can't eat it. And then they're able to revive his spirit. Vayomar lo David, lemi ata ve'emi ze ata. Now, clearly they have no idea who he is, because the first question they ask him is, who are you and where are you from? So clearly they have no idea who this guy is. And then he tells him a fascinating story. Vayomer, na'ar mitzri anochi. I'm an Egyptian lad. Eved le'ish amalaki. Slave to Amalek. So what am I doing here on the side of the road? Vayazveini Adoni. My master abandoned me. Left me to die. Why? Ki chaliti yom shlosha. Because 3 days ago I got sick. So 3 days ago I got sick. What do you do with a slave when you get sick? It's no value to you.
Get rid of him.
Right? A slave that gets sick is a burden. So you dump him on the side of the road and you say, okay, you fend for yourself.
It's a miracle he was alive.
Then he tells him the story of how he came to be over here in the middle of, just south of Tziklag. Anachnu pashatnu negev akreti v'al asher yuda v'al negev kalev v'etziklag sarafnu be'esh. Our gedud, our troop, had attacked the southern region, the southern ridge of Yehuda and Negev Kalev and Tziklag and that whole sort of Chevron, Aza, Arad, Beersheva, Tziklag, that whole southern region, what's referred to as Drom Har Chevron, okay, the southern hills of Yehuda. Mm. We had attacked, we had raided these places, we burnt Tziklag to the ground. And now, for the first time, David realizes, and this is, right, this is the realization, that this Mitzri, this Eved, this lad, is his key. Because when David starts to pursue, starts the chase in pursuit of the Gedud, he has no idea who he's chasing, and therefore he has no idea
where they're going.
Right? So he has no idea which direction to go. Do you go south? You know you have to go south, because everything else is Israel, or Plishtim. So you have to go south, but do you go southeast into the Negev, or do you go southwest towards Mitzrayim? You could be completely, and you know the Sinai Desert, you could be chasing for years and not find who you're looking for. So David asked Urim v'Tumim, should he go? And God said yes, but go figure how he's going to find them. They find this lad on the side of the road. They have no idea where he is. He's dying. It looks like this guy could use a good meal. He hasn't eaten in 3 days. They give him a good meal. They revive him. And he says to them, oh, we... And Monsieur Chlifitumo, just innocently, he says, yeah, we were part of an Amalek band. I was a slave to an Amalek troop. We had attacked the southern region. We had attacked Ziklag. We burnt it to the ground. And we went home. And David's jaw drops. Vayomer elav David. Hey, Mitzri. Can you show me where this gedud is? Can you take me to them? Now, if you were the Na'ar Mitzri, and you were a slave to Amalek, who dropped you at the side of the road to die because you got sick 3 days ago. And here comes David and his men and says to you, hey, can you take me back to Amalek? What would you say?
I can't remember.
Gladly.
Gladly. You would say gladly. You would say, I'm going the other way, right? Finally, you've given me some strength. I've got some food in me. I'm going the other way. You can go south. Okay, southeast or southwest. I'm going north. Right? I want to get as far away from these guys as I possibly can. But he doesn't do that. Vayomer, he shavali belokim imtimiteni v'im tazgireni biyad adoni. V'oritcha alagdudazeh. I'll take you there on two conditions. You swear to me, number one, that you're not going to kill me. He doesn't know who he's dealing with, right? He's talking to a band of armed soldiers. He has no idea who he's dealing with. I'll take you there if you swear that you won't kill me. More importantly, if you swear that you won't tazgireni el adoni biad adoni, that you won't give me back to my master. Now remember that in the world of, in any society in which slavery is a legal structure of society, which is pretty much the world up until about 100 years ago, okay, a renegade slave, by definition, by law,
is robbery,
right, must be returned to his master. A runaway slave must be returned to his master. Why? It's written in the Chukei Hammurabi. From the days of the laws of Hammurabi until the negotiated compromise of the Missouri Compromise in the United States. A slave must be returned to his master. Why?
His property.
His property, but that's not the issue. Why must he be returned to his master? Find his keeper. Right? His property is find his keeper.
Well, is it deterrent to other slaves running away?
Exactly. As a deterrent, you have slaves, he has slaves. If I don't return your renegade slaves, then mine will run away and you won't return. Right? It's a basic fabric of the structure of society. Basic economic foundation of a society built around a slave trading economy.
The slaves don't have your return, they'll stampede.
And that's exactly what the North, what was happening in the North and the South in the pre-Civil War. Right, the compromise was that there were states that were allowed not to to extradite slaves to their master. Right? There's a whole piece of, I mean, you're better expert in American history than I am, but
they were against slavery.
Right, so, but that was a contemporary issue. In the days of Tanakh, in the days of Chukei Hammurabi, right, a master finds a runaway slave, by law you return him to his master. So that is exactly what this Na'am Mitzvi, Eved Le'isha Malaki, is thinking. The Torah's law is a little different. Okay? The Torah goes out of its way in Parshat Mishpatim to say, Al Tazkir Eved Al Adonav. In the Torah's law, which sanctioned or allowed slavery to exist, which is a whole different conversation, but it's a fascinating rule, or law that says you're not allowed to extradite a slave to his former master. If a slave runs away, he earns his freedom. In Chukei Hammurabi, now just think about it for a second. In the laws of Hammurabi, it states that a slave runs away, you return him to his master, and as punishment, the master removes an eye or a tooth. Azash deit. Okay? Master removes an eye or a tooth. I could bring you the quote. The Torah's law is, A, if you free a slave, if a slave runs away, Al Tazkir Eved Al Adonai, if you're not allowed to return him to his master. Law number one. Law number two, if you maim a slave by removing their eye or tooth, you set them free. It's a very strange law, because nobody understands why the Torah suddenly would talk about taking out an eye or a tooth of a slave, and by that right, the slave earns his freedom. But when you think about the context in which the world is operating, Chukei Hammurabi was sort of the primary sort of code of law that governed most of the region in the time of Abraham, if you think about it from that context, here's the Torah operating within a region trying to limit the scope of that which was so pervasive in the economy of the world. So two rules that are set out in Parshat Mishpatim that essentially refer specifically to the dynamic of slavery at that time. And here you have a reflection of exactly that story. He says to David, Al Tazgireni bi'ad Adonai, I'll show you, but I want something in return. I want you to promise that you're not going to hand me back. Now, it doesn't tell us what David's response is, but I could assume that if he does what he promised to do, then David probably promised accordingly and agreed. Pasuk Tet Zayin. Vayorideu. So he took them down towards this gedur. Vihine nitushim apnei haaretz. And these Amalekites, they are literally spread out upon the ground, on the earth. Ochlim v'shotim v'chogigim b'chol ha'shalal ha'gadol shelakhu me'eretz plishtim u'me'eretz Yehuda. They are having a feast, eating and drinking and celebrating this bounty. They have never had such a successful raid in all the years. They've raided the southern region of Yehuda and the southern region of Eretz Plishtim, if they don't draw a distinction, and they've had the most successful raid they've ever had. Because, right, because the army was all up north. Right? And why describe them as netushim opnei kol haaretz, literally spread out upon the earth? What's eating and drinking and celebrating and right, what does that tell me about this Amalekite group? If they're literally spread out, netushim, eating and drinking and celebrating, what aren't they doing?
They weren't worried about anything.
Right, they're not worried about being attacked. Now, if you're a disciplined army, why would you do that? You've just attacked a bunch of cities. Why would you not be concerned about self-protection from the...
I guess they figured if they're up north, then they're not going to be back for a while. So they didn't think they had any...
David threat. Catches them off guard. David catches them by surprise. Because remember, David went with Achish. And Achish's army is heading north. Never in a million years did Amalek consider the possibility that Achish would send David home. The reason they timed this raid when they did was because the army of the Plishtim were heading north. This was the perfect opportunity. I've been waiting for this opportunity for years. The perfect opportunity to attack and raid and capture slaves and hold back a fortune. And Achish and his army, they're 3 days, they're heading north. They're nowhere to be seen. So they are literally celebrating Nitushim opnei haaretz, ochlim v'shotim v'chogegim. They are just living it up. Never in a million years did they suspect that they would be attacked. And suddenly over the ridge shows up David and his band of 400 plus. Vayakem. Vayakem David me'aneshef v'ad erev lemochoratam. David began a battle that lasted a day and a half. A day and a half. Most battles are decided in a matter of hours in the biblical context. Right? Remember the famous battle of Yeshua in Givon, the Shemesh b'Givon Dom, Ma'ameach ba'Emach Ayalon. They fought from the morning till the afternoon. The sun was setting. He wanted the sun in their eyes of the enemy, so he had this special tefillah. That was a one-day battle. Battles don't take days, weeks. Me'aneshev yad erev, from the morning till night, l'machotam, until the next day. Day and a half, David's 400 men fought against Amalek. V'lo milat mehem ish, ki im 400 ish na'ar, asher achvu al agmalim yanusu. There were no survivors. It was killed everybody except some minuscule percentage of 400 men who managed to escape. 400 young men on camels managed to escape. David said, let them go. Vayatzel David et kol asher lakhu Amalek. And David at that moment manages to restore everything Amalek had taken. Food and clothing and wealth, including the people that Shtei Nashav, Itzil David, his two wives, ולא נהדר להם מן הקטון ועד הגדול ועד בנים ובנות ומשלל ועד אשר לקחו להם הכל השיב דוד. The women, the children, the men, the boys, the girls, the money they stole, everything. They had literally returned everything intact. They freed all the slaves, everything that they had taken, everything returned to David. Vayikach David et kol hatzon ve'abakar nagu lifnei hamikne ahu. They took all of the cattle and all of the animals and all of the sheep and all of the spoils. They rode them out before David's camp. Vayamru, and they said, I think they did more than said, they probably sung, Ze shlal David, the spoils of David's war. What an extraordinary battle. How many did David fight against?
Does it say?
I have no idea.
No idea. Take a wild guess.
Well, they fought for a day.
Order of magnitude. Put an order of magnitude to it.
I would say at least three times the number that order of David. It's at least 1,200.
At least 1,200.
I'm guessing.
Okay. Don't forget that lo nimlat lehem ish ki im arbamiot. The survivors were considered like nothing, right? Not a single one survived except for 400 lad. 400 young lad. They were not worth chasing after.
So maybe
that's what survived. Right? So that's an expression that would reflect 10 times that, 20 times that, right? An army. An army of thousands. Maybe tens of them, right? Huge. Nitushim apnei kol haaretz. This is, understand this, this is all of Amalek. Amalek are nomads. Amalek are marauders. Amalek are slave traders. This was the biggest haul Amalek had ever accomplished. This was all of Amalek in one. Nitushim apnei kol haaretz. David attacks, and he literally, there's nothing left except a minuscule of remnant of 400 survivors. Later, many years later, Chizkiyahu will fight against Amalek and referred to as fighting against the Sherita Pleita, the survivors of David's campaign against Amalek. David literally wipes Amalek off the map.
Does he know about Shaul and
I would assume so.
Oh, okay.
Why wouldn't he? Everybody knows.
I was just wondering if he knew to wipe them out.
The command? I don't think, but that's not, I don't think that's the issue.
Right.
That's not the issue, right?
Right.
It's but it's a fascinating moment. There's a lot of things that we're going to explore in this story, but one thing for sure it does is puts to bed the myth of two things. Number one, the myth that Shaul destroyed all of Amalek except for one man named Agag. And that from Agag was reborn the descendants of Amalek. That's a myth. Clearly that's a myth because...
Here they are.
And this is a year later.
And there's so many.
Okay? There's not 10,000 people born from Agag who are now soldiers ready to fight David in a year. So that story we need to reevaluate in light of this campaign. But clearly Shaul did not destroy all of Amalek save one man. That's a myth. And we talked about that myth way back when, but here's the other half of that story. This is where you see it. The other myth that it puts to bed is the implication, which is also part of that story, that some of the Mefarshim suggest, which is that the reason why Shaul failed and the reason why God was so angry at him was because he spared the cattle. And Rashi has this really extraordinary midrash that says that the reason why Amalek survived was because the people were able to disguise themselves as animals. And therefore, he didn't realize that by sparing the metav hatzon, by sparing the sheep and the spoils of the animals, he allowed Amalek to survive. Okay, why is that myth put to bed? How many verses here to describe the shalal of the tzon ha'bakar that David takes from Amalek and nobody blinks, nobody bats an eyelash. Not a problem. There's no restriction against the shalal, the spoils of the war against Amalek. But all the Mephoshim would say, you're mandated by the Torah to destroy Amalek until the last living soul, including the animals. Therefore, you're not allowed to take of the shalal. Right? That was the, according to that theory, that was the chet of shol. And clearly, that's not. There's no problem taking the shalal. So both of those issues are challenged by this story, which begs the question, so what did Shaul do wrong, and what did David do right?
Yeah, but wouldn't that command to have destroyed all the cattle have only been on Shaul?
Okay,
not
well, but then
transferable
why?
To somebody else?
So why? Okay. That begs the question, why? So I don't think there was I don't think the issue is the cattle. I think the cattle is a symptom of a different type of issue, which we'll come back to, B'ezrat Hashem, when we explore this in detail. But clearly, this story stands in striking contrast to the story of Shaul's campaign against Amalek, where he was told to destroy Amalek, and he didn't, and David, who's not told to destroy Amalek,
but he does.
And he does. Effectively.
Almost.
As effectively as the Torah would ever have expected it. Again, the Torah, and this comes back to our foundational piece with Amalek. The Torah never mandated, give the expression genocide. Not an issue. It's not the language of the Torah. What the Torah mandated was the destruction of a force that was immoral and would be a thorn in our side and a constant threat unless we removed the threat. How did you remove a threat of terrorists? By fighting their army? Or by going house to house and removing the terrorists one by one? It's a problem, right? Against an army, against a kingdom, against a nation, you have an army. You fight the army, you declare victory, and you win. Against nomadic terrorists, it's a much more complicated campaign. Right? Look in contemporary terms. Look at Taliban, look at ISIS, look at every campaign against a group that's organized as a group of terrorists. You can't win by defeating them on the battlefield.
Amalek never had a state of its own.
Correct. They're nomads.
They're nomads. There was no capital. There was
correct.
No.
So explain to me what it
government.
Says when it says that Shaul attacked the city of Amalek and captured their king.
Well,
you're 100% correct. They're nomads. They have no capital. They have no region. They have no state, and they have no king. So why does it tell me in Perek Tetvav of Sefer Shmuel that Shaul attacked attacked Amalek, Vayilachem Beir Amalek, and he captured Agag Melech Amalek? They have no capital. They have no king.
Well, a king may have just been a self-appointed title. The way you have with, you know, organized crime, you know, the chairman
okay.
of the board. You know,
and Ir Amalek?
That may just be where they gathered.
Or, okay, I'll buy that. Or, one other possibility is that the moment of Shaul's attack, the moment of the charge to Shaul to attack Amalek is a moment of an attempt by Amalek to reorganize themselves into some kind of structured nation. Some kind of the beginning roots of nationalism amongst Amalek. And so there's a city Amalek, and there's a king Amalek. Now, does that explain where Amalek lives? No, because they're nomads. They're living all the way out Baruch Hashur and out Eretz Mitzrayim. But the beginning, so when Shaul attacks Amalek, who does he attack?
The king.
The king.
The leader.
The city, and captures the king. And if you fight against an army, an organized army, if you're fighting a political battle or a military battle against a state, and you capture the king, what does that mean?
You won.
Battle's over. But when you're fighting against a nomadic troop of terrorists, your battle's not over until...
They're all gone.
Until you go house to house. May I neshefi ad aboker.
Not to get overly contemporary, but you see that with contemporary terrorist groups.
Correct.
You kill the guy who's head of it, you know, you go into his bedroom and shoot him dead, but the group continues right on.
Correct. That's exactly my point.
Or you had this ISIS with its Islamic state.
That's what I said before.
Really a state, but they were trying to get it into one.
100%. That is exactly what I was referring to before, that it's a fundamentally different kind of battle. And the mistake Shaul plays out is he fought a battle against a very, in his mind, a very different enemy. You fight the war, you fight the battle, you capture the king, game is over. Whereas the battle mandate that God had given him was, you go house to house and you eradicate every single fighter. Now, again, we've talked about the language of the Torah, the military language of the Torah. And the military language of the Torah speaks in hyperbolic phrases. L'tachaya kol neshama, not to leave any survivors, etc. But I don't think for a minute the Torah mandated going into every house and killing the babies in the cradle. Right? That's not the issue in Amalek. And Chazal have this description, but that's not the issue. The issue is to make sure that you eradicate the threat. For that you need a very different kind of battle plan. That you need a David and his men to go literally house to house, or to find them netushim al pnei kol haaretz. There's no better opportunity than to take the entire group out in one shot. But that's what Shaul didn't have. Shaul fought. Remember the campaign in Perek Tadvav. Shaul shows up at the doorstep of Amalek, makes a public announcement to Bnei Kini to separate themselves from the rest of Amalek because they're going to attack tomorrow. So ends the element of surprise. Right? Attacks publicly, capital city, captures the king, declares victory. But Amalek's not the king and it's not in the capital. Amalek is up Pnei Kol Haaretz. So the notion that somehow Shaul's mistake was that he killed everybody except the Gog, or except the animals that were people disguised as animals, it doesn't fit in the pshat. But what makes much more sense is that Shaul fought a very different kind of battle, misread the mandate completely. Fought a political campaign and fight instead of a moral one that would take them into every household to eradicate the threat. Now, if you come back to the issue of the spoils of war, to the shalal, there, that plays into the same story. When do you take shalal? When do you take spoils of war? Not from whom, but when?
After the war is over.
When the war is over. And Shaul knows his army. Back in the Battle of Michmas, when he made an oath, made all of his officers swear that in the midst of the battle they wouldn't eat. Remember that story?
Yeah.
They wouldn't eat. David and his son Yonatan is in the forest and they're tired and he eats from the honey of the sap of the tree and he revives himself, and there's this whole conversation. Why does he make that decree? Because he knows his people. And he knows if he gets them to stop and eat, that'll be the end of the chase. And that battle was against Plishtim. Spoils of war you take when the war is over. In Shaul's case, was the war over? To Shaul it was, but to the Navi, from the mandate of what he was given, he hadn't even scratched the surface. So the spoils were a reflection of the fact that in Shaul's case, he stopped the war prematurely, took the spoils of war, declared victory, and went home. Here, the spoils of war are only described after the battle's over. 400 lads escape, and they're not even worth fighting. The threat is over, and now we have a description of the spoils of war. Now we can go home.
Why wouldn't Shmuel tell Shaul, if you know he's directing him to kill everybody, why wouldn't he tell him the kind of war he should fight?
I think he did.
Oh.
I think it was very clear.
Oh, okay.
Shmuel told him a lot of times, and he doesn't listen because he.
I wasn't.
Lech vikitat, lech vikitat Amalek, go and attack Amalek. V'hacharamtem et kol asher lo, destroy them entirely. V'lo tachmol alav, without mercy. V'imatam mi'ish v'yad isha mi'olel v'yad yonek mishor v'yad tzem mi'gamal v'yad chamor. And again, Chazal look at that literally in terms of men, women, and children and babies, but in the context of the language of the Torah, the language of the Torah is that's a war, that's the kind of language the Torah would say when it says you go and you eradicate the threat house to house if necessary. Okay. House to house if necessary. Shaul, Vaishama Shaul et Am, Vaifkadim et La'im, Shaul gathers together an enormous army of 200,000 people. He comes to Ir Amalek. Vayavo Shaul ad Ir Amalek. Vayara benachal. And then Vayoma Shaul lakeni, Lechu suru rudu mitoch Amalek. Then he makes a public announcement. He drops leaflets out in the Amalek camp and he tells all the Bnei Keni, go home, because we don't have no fight with you. So the Keni move, and in the meantime, the Amalek are not just sitting there. Vayach Shaul Amalek. And now here's the mystery. If you look at this pasuk, it's in Perek Tekvav Pasuk Zion. Vayach Shaul Amalek mechavila bo'acha shur asher apnei Mitzrayim. Shaul smote Amalek from chavila all the way down to shur until Mitzrayim. Vayitpos et Agag melech Amalek chai ve'et kol ha'am echlim lefichar. Captured this king of Agag. And the people destroyed by the sword. Shaul and the people had compassion over Agag and the Tzon. It's a bit of a strange verse. Shaul had compassion over Agag. The people had compassion over the spoils of war. Okay. So the mystery here is Pasuk Zion. Because everybody reads this Pasuk as Vayach Shaul et Amalek Mi chavila baracha shur al pnei Mitzrayim. Shaul smote Amalek all the way from chavila down to Mitzrayim. Total comprehensive campaign, nobody left. And yet, comes to Perek Lamed, and I have thousands left. Understand the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Simple solution. Mechavila bo'acha shur apnei Mitzrayim is not a description of the campaign, but a description of where Amalek lived. Vayach Shaul et Amalek. And Amalek asher who lived mechavila bo'acha shur apnei kol Mitzrayim. But where was the battle?
Vayilachem
be'ir Amalek. Shaul doesn't go further than Ir Amalek, whatever Ir Amalek means, because we don't know of city named Amalek, they're nomads. But you see the nomadic description of Amalek that are living literally, here's, you see it on the map. Shur, Amalek, look down at the map in the southern, south, bottom left corner of the map. Amalek, Shur. Right, they're literally scattered all the way down to, I don't have the map here, but. Okay, that along the coast of the and Sinai all the way down to Mitzrayim. Shaul fought in the Negev. Shaul fought Ir Amalek. But Amalek is Michavela Baruch Hashur. Shaul doesn't get anywhere near that. You just have to split the verse. Vayach Shaul et Amalek, not as describing the battle, but describing Amalek. Amalek who lived Michavela Baruch Hashur. Otherwise, this parak has. I'm left with the only explanation, which is that they were all people disguised as animals. Which, again, I in the pshat of Tanakh, I can't do anything with. So that's the battle. When it's all over, David comes back with his shalal, with his spoils of war.
Does he give all that back to where we came
from? We're going to get to that in a second. We're going to get to that in a second. Which brings us to Pasuk Chaf. Okay, the battle with Amalek is now over. So the battle of Amalek was described from Pasuk Tet Zayin through Yutet. Correct? And in those three psukim, David eradicates the threat of Amalek more or less for all time, what Shaul never was able to do. Vayikach David, Pasuk Chaf, Vayikach David et kol hatzon ve'abakar, nagu lifnei mikneu, they took all of this cattle that they took from Amalek, and they spread it out before David, vayomer zesh lal David. Vayavod David al matayim ha'anashim asher pigru milechet acharei David. Remember those 200 men got left behind? Now we're back to that story. So that story started our campaign, and now it's coming back to that story. That's why I said it's the sort of the framework of this parak. Vayoshivum benachal habesor. Right? Remember those 200 people who couldn't catch up with David, who couldn't manage to cross the Nachal in time, and were left on the other side of Nachal Besor. And they came out to greet David and his army. Vaygash David et ha'am. David embraces his people. Vayishalem shalom. And he greets them and he embraces them and he seeks their well-being. And how are you? And shalom aleichem. And how is it? And you're okay? And everybody's here? And, okay. Vayan kol ish ra uvliya'al. And in this conversation pipes up the 400 men who went to war, and they are described as Ra and Bliya'al. Those are two words that are very, they ring in Sefer Shmuel, they ring, right? Bliya'al was the last, was Naval HaKarmeli was described as Bliya'al, and Bnei Eli, Chofni and Pinchas were described as Bliya'al. Not a term you throw around lightly.
So you said Sefer Shmuel. I was thinking more Shoftim.
Shoftim? Where does it say Bliya'al and Shoftim?
Wow, that's when we first started talking Bliya'al. When Pinchas and Chofni were.
That's in Shmuel.
It is?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
B'nai Eli, fall of the Mishkan is beginning of Shoftim.
I don't know, there's just so many horrible
beginning of Shmuel.
Shoftim, I thought they had
to be. No. That's in Shmuel. Perek Dalet. Actually, they are in Perek Aleph and Bet, and then the fall of Shiloh is in Perek Dalet. Vayan kol ish ra uvliyal meha'anashim ha'shalachuim David. From the 400 men who went with David, piped up anashay ra uvliyal. It's not all four of the 100 of them, but it's amongst them there are these. So David had gathered around him a group that was hotheads and militants, and they wanted to kill Shaul at the first opportunity and at the second opportunity, and they want... it's an interesting group of people that David has surrounding him, right? But he had no choice. That's, you know, beggars can't be choosy. He's in exile, and that's who he managed to pull together, and they were good warriors. Mari Nafesh turned on David and blamed him the moment anything goes wrong, right? They're an interesting crew. Yan kolish rauf liyam min hashem shalchuim David vayomru Yan asher lo alchu imi lo niten lehem me'ashalal asher itzalnu. They didn't come and fight. These jobnikim, they sat down on the other side of Nachal Besor, these lazy bums who couldn't cross the river. And you want to give them from the shalal that we risked our lives to take? Kim ish et let them take their wives and their children and go home. But the shalal belongs to the warriors. We fought. We risked our lives. These lazy bums sat on the other side of the river singing kumzit songs. Vayomer David. Now, here's one of those moments where you sort of, yeah, just take a step back and you look at it and you say, David's extraordinary patience. But it's more than patience. It's the personality of David. Vayomer David, lo ta'asu ken echai. My brothers. That's not nice. to these Anshei Ra'u B'liya'al, David says, Achai, my brothers, it's pasnished. Nice. That doesn't fit. Loto, lota sukein. No, that's not nice. Et asher natan Hashem lanu? God who gave us this shalal. Vayishmor otanu, and God protected us. Vayiten et hagdud haba aleinu biyadeinu. God gave this gedud into our hands. Umi yishma lachem ledavar zeh? Would that you would just listen to this thing that I'm telling you now. And here he says it, and it's one of the most famous quotes that David articulates. Ki kechelek hayored b'melchama ukechelek hayoshev al hakelim yachdav yachlok. Those who go into battle and those who stay behind to watch the camp, they will share the spoils of war equally. So says David HaMelech, Vayehi mi'ayom ha'u v'mala v'yasimeh l'chok u'lemishpat li'Yisrael ad ha'yom hazeh. And so, to quote Cecil B. DeMille's Yul Brynner, so let it be written, so let it be done. David's mishpat word is law. Now he's not yet king. Right? He's not yet king. But this is the night that Shaul is going to fall in battle, and so for all intents and purposes, he is king. Mm-hmm. Right? Or he's going to be king. And here you have his first decree that becomes law for generations to come. Kechela kiyored b'melchama ukechela kiyoshev al hakelim yachdav yachlok. They will share the spoils of war equally. Without bias or preference to one group over another. And so he divides the shalal between
everybody.
How many groups?
Two groups.
The fighters and
two groups?
The guards.
Four. Not quite. Three. Vayavod David el Tziklag. David comes to Tziklag. Vayishalach mea shalal lezikne Yehuda. Then he sends all from this shalal, he also sends a portion to all of the elders of Yehuda. Hine lachem bracha mishlal oyve Hashem, a blessing from the spoils of the war against the enemies of God. Lasot lasher bebet el velasher b'ramot negev velasher b'yatir velasher b'aroer velasher b'sifmod ולעשר באש דמוע, ולעשר ברחל, ולעשר בריח מלי, ולעשר בריח קני, ולעשר בחורמה, ולעשר בחורשן, ולעשר בעתך, ולעשר בחברון, לכל המקומות אשר יתהלך שם דוד ובנשיו. That's a shira, by the way. That's not a sentence, that's a song. Like the song of the kings. In Sefer Yeshua,
Malach Yerusha,
it's a victory song. It's a list of all of the cities that David sent of the spoils of the war against Amalek to return to them from all of the cities that had been persecuted by Amalek for all of these generations. All the raiding parties of Amalek, they all got a portion of the shalal. So now he's divided the shalal into essentially three fundamental parts. The army got their portion. Both the portion, the army, both those who fought and those who stayed behind, and all of the cities under his tutelage, under his leadership, that were loyal to him, or that were suffered under the hands of Amalek, they got a portion, and the shalal was divided amongst them all in a kind of a victory shir at the end of the parak. So it's a fascinating story, and the piece of this, the role that the shalal plays in this parak is proportionately larger than any other part of the story. I don't think that's an accident. I think it's a reflection of the piece, the role that it plays in the dynamic of David and his men, and that's really the piece of this parak. This parak has two themes. Theme number one, David's attack on Amalek and his destruction of Amalek, doing what Shaul never was able to do on the night that Shaul is going to die in battle. theme number two is the internal struggle and the internal strife within David's own camp and amongst his own men that David needs to address, channel, manage, and establish in the moral code by which David and his army will exist. That's those two themes of this parak. There's one more theme in this parak, which is Amalek, and that we will come to Bezrat Hashem in our next session on this parak, which will be next week.